Headlines, a chief of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement says Palestinians emerged victorious following Israel's recent aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip thanks to their unity and sacrifice. The Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, addresses the Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia, saying the occasion is a historic opportunity that could open a new phase in Arab cooperation. And Denmark announces a willingness to help train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets after the U.S. expresses support for the training. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Chief of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement hails Palestinians' victory against Israel during the regime's recent aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip. Ziad al-Nakhala made the remarks in an event to commemorate the 33 Palestinians killed in Israeli attacks, including civilians and the movement's leaders. He said the regime was forced to accept Palestinians' terms for a ceasefire in the face of hundreds of rockets fired into occupied territories. Nakhala added the Palestinians dealt another blow to Israel's already tarnished image. The Palestinian official attributed the victory to Palestinian unity and sacrifice. Nakhala also thanked the countries that have supported the Palestinians, particularly Iran. He stressed the Palestinians are more determined than ever to defend their rights and liberate their land. Nakhala also vowed a strong and painful response to any future Israeli assassination of the group's commanders. Syria-based Palestinian factions have gathered in Damascus countryside to participate in an event following the victory of resistance groups in a recent battle with Israel in the besieged Gaza Strip. Our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, has your story.
The Islamic Jihad resistance movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the joint operations room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus countryside.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad expressed hope the Arab League summit will pave the way for joint Arab action to achieve prosperity in the region rather than war and destruction.
There is an added hope amid the Arab-Arab as well as the Arab regional and international rapprochement brought in by this summit, which I hope will signal a new phase in Arab coordination and solidarity among us, and peace and prosperity in our region instead of war and destruction.
Assad described the bloc's 32nd summit hosted by Saudi Arabia as a historic opportunity to address crises throughout the region without foreign interference. It was the first time Assad addressed the organization since Syrian membership was suspended back in 2011 amid foreign-backed militancy to topple the Syrian government. Now, Syria returned to the Arab League earlier this month and it followed normalization of ties between Syria and Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Countries' return to the Arab fold comes after Assad's government regained control of most areas seized by militants. Our Damascus correspondent walked us through some of the important comments made by the Syrian president during his speech at the Arab League summit.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad highlighted the dangers surrounding some parts of the Arab world, and he underlined the importance of this Arab League summit and stressed that such a summit should discuss and solve some issues, mainly speaking about the crimes of the Israeli occupation, of course, over there on the Palestinians. Also, the dangers, as he described it, of the Turkish side in the Arab world, especially here. He was definitely referring to the situation in Syria. We all know that there are still Turkish forces occupying parts of Syria in the north. He also spoke, President Assad, about the importance of addressing and solving the challenges of development in the Arab world, of course. He said that joint Arab action requires visions, strategies, and joint goals at the end of the day. President Assad and Syrian officials in general always stress the importance of joint Arab action. And previously, Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad, in the past couple of 2 days, also underlined the importance of joint Arab action. And he also thanked Saudi Arabia for boosting that joint Arab action. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had two separate meetings before the Arab League summit started this morning with his Tunisian counterpart and the UAE vice president. He shook hands before he entered that room with the Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. This is a significant, of course, development. He had a quick chat with him on the sideline. We all know that Qatar's position with regards to Syria, its policy, is still more of a negative one, though it did, at the end of the day, accept and welcome Syria's return to the Arab League. President Bashar al-Assad also shook hands with the Egyptian president. It's a very important visit for the Syrian president in order to meet all of those Arab leaders that many of them cut ties with Syria previously in the past decade.
Now, Denmark says it will help train Ukrainian pilots to fly U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets. This comes after Washington gave a green light to the training. Denmark's defense minister said this will be part of a collective contribution to train the airmen. Earlier, U.S. President Joe Biden told G7 leaders Washington supports supplying advanced warplanes, including F-16s, to Kiev. The U.S. was previously opposed to the idea over its cost and the length of time it'll take to complete. Washington has also ruled out sending warplanes of its own to Ukraine. Pledge to provide fighter jet support to Kiev has been spearheaded by the United Kingdom and the Netherlands. Strained ties between Russia and the West over the Ukraine war once again take the spotlight. President Vladimir Putin's accused the West now of attempting to pit Russian ethnic groups against one another and try to partition the country. We've been discussing the issue earlier with our guests in our news review program.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the Russian president warns of a Western plot to break the country up into dozens of different states.
Practically the whole arsenal is aimed against us. Economic, military, political, and informational. Most powerful anti-Russian propaganda has been unfolded. The attacks on our history, culture, spiritual values are ongoing, as well as attempts to drive a wedge in the brotherhood and unity of the peoples of our country. They say Russia should be divided up into tens of small different states, and it's clear what this is for, to subdue to their will, to exploit and use in their interests.
Vladimir Putin added that the more sanctions the West imposes on Russia, the more cohesive Russian society becomes. Tensions between Russia and the West have hit decades-high levels over the war in Ukraine. Moscow says the war is aimed at demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine, while Kiev's Western allies say it's an unprovoked land grab. The West has slapped unprecedented sanctions on Russia while providing financial and military aid to Ukraine. Moscow says the sanctions have failed to achieve their goal and warned that the increasing NATO involvement in the war could lead to a direct confrontation with Russia. And joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Johnny Miller, who's joining us from Moscow. Also, we have researcher at Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, Mr. Greg Simons, who's joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Johnny Miller. Johnny, walk us through the recent comments made by the Russian president. He believes that there's a Western plot to break up the Russian Federation into dozens of different states.
Well, I think he's right in suggesting that that's certainly a desire of the West. I think this war in Ukraine has three elements. First of all, it's a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking population, particularly in the south and in the east. Second of all, it's an attempt by Russia to secure, as it sees it, its geostrategic security, in particular Crimea, and they do want to take some land in order to achieve that aim and also to stop a NATO expansion and demilitarization of Ukraine. And thirdly, it's an attempt by NATO countries, in particular the United States, to damage Russian power. And I think that's what Vladimir Putin is alluding to there. This war isn't really about Ukraine anymore. It's a war between NATO and the West, a war between the United States' attempts to retain its global hegemony and Russia's attempts to reassert itself in the world and, as they see it, to protect their own interests. So that's very much what the war in Ukraine has become about. And the fear is also that, I'm in Moscow at the moment, and there really is not much of a feeling that there is a war going on here. Russian society is carrying on as normal. The sanctions haven't really damaged Russian people too much. Russia has can mobilize a lot more of its manpower, a lot more of its economy, if it needs to, whereas Ukraine is really mobilizing its entirety of its ability. So the fear is also that this war between the West and the East may not stop with Ukraine. It may spread elsewhere.
Greg Simons, following up on the comments made by the Russian president, why would the United States and its allies benefit from a broken and fragmented Russia?
Well, it's always been along that this is a desire to break it up. I mean, they've even produced a map of how they would like to see it broken up. So, but the point is, Russia is a subject and not an object of international relations at the moment. They want Russia to be not even a vassal state, a client state, like it used to be under Yeltsin until the end. So they don't want independent foreign policy, independent politics. They want Russia to do their bidding. I mean, this is what the US has always wanted from other countries around the world. This is not about partnerships or symmetrical relations. It's always been about asymmetry with the US and their unipolar hegemony.
Greg Simons, staying with you, the Russian president once again warned that increasing NATO involvement in the war could lead to a direct confrontation with Russia as this war drags on. And NATO countries continue to pump more arms and ammunition into Ukraine. The prospect is still there that this could spill over or morph into something bigger, and with it also result in a direct confrontation with Russia. Break that down for us, please.
Well, yes. I mean, there's always that issue, of course. From the comments and the analysis you're getting from Russia is much more, what do you say, sober and realistic than these kind of jingoistic slogans and catchphrases coming from the West. The West has been at the top for too long and show all the signs of being an empire in decline. And when an empire goes in decline, the first part of an empire that goes into decline are things like its intellectual capacity and its ethical standing. And you can see this in the West now. And so, yes, when you get things like this declining, this increases the possibility for something spreading. I mean, if we look at how World War I started, quite innocently, but it rapidly spread. The fact that this has not spread already much more than it has, I mean, it's no small miracle. And that's not owing to the West that uses Orwellian language about war for peace.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Johnny Miller joining us from Moscow, and Greg Simon speaking to us from Uppsala, Sweden. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the Newsery.
Welcome back, everyone. Now, the U.S. has imposed fresh sanctions targeting Iran and Russia as the two countries move to enhance relations. The State Department designated two Iranian shipping companies a port operator and maritime service provider. It said that they were part of a logistics network between Moscow and Tehran. Now, relations have angered the West, and that includes a recent agreement between Iran and Russia for the construction of a railroad section that will connect southern Asia to northern Europe through Azerbaijan. U.S. says it is deeply concerned by any move that tries to curtail sanctions. Tehran has brushed aside the concerns, though, saying the Rasht Astara railroad project is part of its neighbor-oriented strategy based on cooperation for common security, development, and welfare. The European Union's refugee policy goes under the spotlight again in the European Parliament, being branded as illegal under international law and discriminatory. Refugees in Belgium claim those seeking asylum from Ukraine are receiving preferential treatment. Scuffles break out between demonstrators and police in Budapest as thousands of Hungarians rally against controversial reforms to how teachers work. The protesters chanted slogans and held signs denouncing the so-called status law. They also slammed what they're calling the use of excessive force by police against demonstrators. Status law eliminates the public servant status of teachers and increases their workload. Almost 5,000 teachers have already warned that they will quit if this bill comes into law. Hungary has seen a series of rallies and strikes for higher pay and better working conditions for teachers. This amid an inflation of around 24% that has eroded wages already below the national average. And that's it for your latest review, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, a new survey has found that many people cite a lack of time and feeling too tired as barriers to living a healthier lifestyle. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. A lack of time and lack of motivation are putting people off getting fit, a new poll has suggested. The World Cancer Research Fund said these were some of the main barriers preventing people from making healthy changes to their diet and being more physically active. Other barriers include people not knowing where to start, a lack of confidence, and feeling too tired. The cost of gym membership and food prices also appear to put people off making healthier choices, the new poll has suggested. Almost a quarter of those people who took part in the survey said that nothing prevents them from eating healthily and being physically active. More than 2,000 British adults were asked which, if any, of the following prevents you from making healthy changes to your diet and being more physically active. The new opinion poll conducted by YouGov on behalf of the charity found that 38% said a lack of motivation prevented them from eating healthily and being more active. 35% said they feel too tired. 26% said they did not have time. 25% cited their work-life balance. 25% cited the cost of exercising, such as gym membership or equipment fees, as a barrier to being more physically active. And 30% said food costs were preventing them from eating more healthily. 16% said that they lacked confidence, while 12% claimed they did not know where to start. The figures show disparities among age groups, with nearly half of younger adults aged between 25 and 34 citing feeling too tired as a barrier, compared with 23% of 55-year-olds. Some 29% of men said feeling too tired was preventing them from making healthier choices, compared with 40% of women. The World Cancer Research Fund has launched a free healthy living plan called Active 8, where participants receive regular emails over 8 weeks to help make healthy eating and getting more active a part of their daily routine. Matt Lambert, Health Information and Promotion Manager at the World Cancer Research Fund, said living in a healthier way, whether that's cooking from scratch more often or getting more active, can be easily said than done, especially when tiredness and motivation play such an important role. It can also be challenging knowing where to start, let alone motivating ourselves to make changes to our lifestyle. That's why, with the help of Active 8, we want to support and empower people on their journey towards being healthier. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. It's the question many of us ask ourselves: why don't I exercise more, eat better food, and generally lead a healthier lifestyle? For many who want to, but just can't seem to make it happen, it turns out the answer to that question is, well, feeling just too tired. A new survey has found that tiredness is why 35% of people don't make the changes to their diet and physical activity levels that would help them close the gap between good intentions and concrete action. The results from a YouGov opinion poll of 2,086 British adults for the World Cancer Research Fund illustrate the barriers many people face in their desire to adopt and stick to healthy habits. When asked what was stopping them from eating more healthily and exercising more often, 29% of men and 40% of women cited feeling too tired. Even more put it down to lack of motivation, 38%. Other common reasons given include the cost of food, 30%. Lack of time, 26%. The work-life balance, 25%. Others cited the cost of exercising, 25%. Such as buying a gym membership or equipment, and lack of confidence, 16%, and not knowing where to start, 12%. Only 1 in 4 people, or about 25% in the representative sample of the British population surveyed online, said nothing prevented them from making healthy changes to their lifestyle. Matt Lambert, the charity's health information and promotion manager, said, "People have busy schedules, and we know that for many, the last thing they might want to do when they are tired or lacking in motivation is to start cooking from scratch or going to the gym." The World Cancer Research Fund is launching an 8-week healthy living plan, which it hopes will enable people to build healthier habits into their routine. It said eating well and taking exercise were important ways of reducing people's risk of getting cancer and other diseases. 1 in 2 people will get cancer at some point in their lives. The charity and Cancer Research UK estimate that 40% of all cases of cancer could be avoided if more people lived healthier lifestyles, for example, by eating more healthily, being active, exercising more, maintaining a normal weight, avoiding sunburn, and not smoking. The Department of Health and Social Care said it was promoting healthier lifestyles to boost physical and mental health, for example, through its Better Health, Every Mind Matters campaign launched last week. The campaign encourages people to use free apps such as Couch to 5K and Active 10 to boost their activity levels.
Food for thought.
Salam, and here is some excellent food for thought from Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, the 16th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Beware of three categories of people: the traitor, the oppressor, and the talebearer. He who betrays others for your sake will surely betray you. He who oppresses others for your sake will surely oppress you. And he who bears others' news to you will surely bear your news to others.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: how to begin our life safe from obstacles. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for this session. So, we're going to start our program as usual with a question that Someone has said that I am a young girl. I want to begin my life safe from obstacles. So, you know well that the mistakes in marital, family and social relations are too many. How can we avoid falling into them? Very wise question. So, to understanding the answer of this question, we should know that there are four factors, actually, that lead one to fall into mistakes. The first is psychological factor. It is when man follows his desire and loves himself, his kin, friends, party, or country in a way that his love does not submit to the Islamic values declared in Holy Quran and the Prophetic Sunnah. The cure in this case and here is achieved by submitting the psychological factor to the true wisdom of religion, submission to the will of Allah and relying on Him in the lawful way of living caused the psychological factor to become defeated. Also, the second is material factor that concerns the physical condition of body. It is clear that some mistakes occur due to some pressure caused by a pain that man cannot tolerate, and so he does what he would not do if he were sound or healthy, whether nose or fatigue or also among the material factors. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Colorful Islam Page. And the previous part, we talked about the two factors of beginning our life safe from obstacles. The first one was to submit our psychological fact to the true wisdom of religion. And the second factor was the material factor that concerns the physical condition of the body. But the cure in this case, when factors are material, is to understand that the cure lies in treating the diseases and getting rid of what troubles one's body and annoys his nerves. And the third factor is an intellectual factor, which concerns the shallow cultural level or the kind of culture that one receives. One must get his intellects and cultures from honest sources in order to not become involved in mistakes due to ignorance or wrong information. And also the fourth factor is an environmental factor, like bad friends in the street or school, or an unreligious family cause one to fall into mistakes. So as long as one is influenced by these factors, he will fall into mistakes, and as long as he keeps away from them, he will remain safe. Dear brothers and sisters, you should follow the practical steps first by knowing Allah and being sincere to Him without flattering anyone. You should care much for your bodily health, think correctly, and then choose good persons to be your friends. Thank you for staying.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Al-Aqsa Media Network.
Part 1. Palestine is of great importance to the world's media because of the events and developments that take place there every day. The Israeli occupation leaves no room for the Palestinians to spend a single day without inconveniences, and it does it through various means of repression, murder, confiscation of land, and desecration of sacred sites. And it makes it look like the Palestinians are the bad guys and the Israelis the good ones. This campaign of deliberate misinformation continued for decades until the day came that the Palestinians could provide a narrative that debunked that of the occupation. Through local media, they reached out to the world, communicating their message, all the while aware of the risks involved.
As we know, there are a number of attempts to control countries by occupying the headquarters of television or the occupation of public broadcasters. Israel was working on this aspect to hit the Palestinian media from the first moment through the creation of fear. These steps have failed as of the start and middle and end of this operation because Palestinian media was ever present, always at the scene. They plan for every upcoming Israeli operation, and the way we can tell something is going on is when Israel starts to attack or bomb the media and bring about fear and confusion.
Israel's branding of itself before the civilized world is a civilized and developed country with a national humanitarian project. I think the Palestinian press has managed and operated first and foremost based on a national theme dedicated to the homeland and national responsibility. We portray the image as it is. When Israel targets civilians and children, bombards houses, mosques, hospitals, organizations, and besieges an entire people, we inform the civilized and free world about what Israel is doing. O civilized people and free nations, this is what Israel is doing to us.
What distinguished Al-Aqsa Media Channel in this war was the influence it had on the Zionist front. We were able, by the grace of God Almighty, to infiltrate Zionist media channels and broadcast to the resistance. As you know, the Zionist government and media follow Al-Aqsa Space Channel, and this is confirmed by a Zionist analyst. We could enter homes outside Palestine on TV and radio and show how the resistance succeeded. And this got into the minds of the Zionist enemy within their own homes and influence their policies as part of the psychological warfare that took place in the 2014
war. This is what the Zionist occupation did not want their own people and the people of the world to see, that the Palestinian press has credibility over the news coming out of the Zionist press, which came from statements made by Israeli settlers. They don't have credibility, but the people believe Palestinian media, and this is the fruit of our determination and perseverance.
The Israeli occupation and its army first tried to keep the media away from scenes of carnage during the 2014 Gaza war. But when that didn't work, they went after the journalists. Some of the most important facilities destroyed by the Israeli occupation in 2014 were the five Al-Aqsa Media Network facilities.
The headquarters at Burj Al Shuruq Financial Management Office, the offices at Al Nasr, and the office you are at now were all targeted, as well as the broadcast center.
We all felt like this was the end of us when the broadcaster was targeted. But we don't believe that we are more important than our children and our homes, and the future of Palestine and our feelings do not shy away from embarrassment. Our purpose is that our message to the people should not be disrupted because we believe they need us every second. We were back on air after a few hours of the attack, which was met with a positive response from the community.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network had aired resistance operational information that allowed the Palestinian resistance to defeat a group of Israeli soldiers. an operational failure for Israel was not an option. And so they had to put a stop to the leaking of the truth to the outside world, and then to replace the truth by way of omission or denial.
Repeat with me, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty. No true God but Allah. Al-Qassam brigades have just captured a soldier. Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, praise to be Allah. Let those wounded people at Al-Shaja'iyah rejoice tonight as Al-Qassam brigades capture the soldier.
Those words that prompt me to stand and salute Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades and the souls of their hero martyrs, I greet you from the heart. This is a victory speech that we have started sharing on this blessed night. All respect and salute is due to the Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades. We will start commentating after a short interval. Stay tuned.
That which was reflected through this war, that the Palestinian narrative is credible when it comes to news, we were keen about that. When the Zionist enemies said that five people were killed, we would replay the same information, but without exaggeration of such, reporting that in fact 50 were killed, and we believed that the narrative of the resistance that we knew was genuine. When the Qassam Brigade said they killed 8 Israeli soldiers in Nahal Az, we published it, and this was validated by the Zionist enemy later when they were forced to then confess that indeed 8 of their soldiers were killed. We believe the resistance narrative because they are entitled to be believed.
We believe we have a revolutionary privacy that distinguishes us from others. Frankly, we all received threatening letters to the order that several houses of colleagues were pounded with bombs. One of our colleagues in radio was bombed directly by an F-16 fighter jet. This man, a journalist who was not engaging in any resistance, but targeted due to his employment.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network was but one of 19 media organizations broadcasting from the Gaza Strip, which were bombed, leaving them partially or totally destroyed. Al-Shaab Radio was one such network building reduced to rubble.
We tried to take with us some devices such as a transmitter, which is an expensive device that a radio broadcast relies on. I remember at one time, a colleague started to walk upstairs when all of a sudden an unmanned drone fired rockets at our building. We had to escape the building with no time to take anything with us, not even archives or any electronic device. Conditions were extremely bad when we were leaving, as some were injured due to the panic and stumbling around at 3 o'clock in the morning, seeing nothing in front of them. The tower we worked in after being hit collapsed into debris. When we couldn't grab anything from inside the radio station, we thought we had lost our important archives. We believed we had lost a voice for the people, months of work.
Another Palestinian media organization assaulted by the Israeli forces was a national agency which provides services to local and international stations. This particular site was filmed by a surveillance camera while under attack by Israeli warplanes that let fly several missiles which decimated the area, compelling and hard evidence of a war crime.
We were offering round-the-clock coverage of the deadly night, which they targeted more than 30 houses throughout the Gaza Strip. Many people were displaced from their homes in the north and in Al-Shaja'iya. We're not targeted as journalists individually, but they bombed our whole building, bringing it down with 3 missiles. It means the occupation is trying to silence media, audio and images. It's a crime. They want to kill the journalists in one hit. There were 36 journalists inside the building at the time. They targeted the building with no prior warning so that we had no chance to evacuate the building beforehand.
It's natural for journalists to be frightened, cautious, and not want to stay long in places that clearly are a potential target of Israeli missiles, Many evacuated from their news desks and resorted to working out of hotels in their continued efforts to write and prevent their words and video footage from being silenced by the invading Israeli forces.
I come from Khan Yunis city. I had to move to Gaza because of the very harsh security situation. As a journalist, I come to stay in a hotel where I am sure I can provide the needed life and coverage services to Press TV. I was injured in 1 in the morning. I was attending my work. I was doing this work in an area that is known to be full of journalists from the different media outlets, including some foreign journalists who are doing some live coverage and media coverage in general for some international and regional media channels. This is the area where I was targeted and injured. And where I sustained my injuries, I tried my best to stay awake. I tried my best also to establish what was happening, but it was far beyond my capacity because of the very strong explosion and because of the surprise and because of the injury.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Economists across the globe agree that if the U.S. goes into a debt default, what is left of U.S. credit and trust will be lost, and this will have a devastating effect on the U.S. economy. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story. The White House said on Tuesday, 16th of May, that U.S. President Joe Biden has cut back a major upcoming trip to Asia and will return to Washington early for talks to avert a potentially catastrophic debt default. President Biden flew to Japan on Wednesday, 17th of May, for a G7 summit, but subsequent stops in Papua New Guinea and Australia were scrapped to deal with a domestic standoff over raising U.S. borrowing limits. The White House said in a statement, President Biden will return to the United States on Sunday, 21st of May, following the completion of the G7 summit, in order to be back for meetings with congressional leaders to ensure that Congress takes action by the deadline to avert a default. The statement added, the president and his team will continue to work with congressional leadership to deliver a budget agreement that can reach the president's desk. The Washington standoff over raising of the U.S. government's $31.4 trillion borrowing limit is added to global economic worries, as a new nonpartisan congressional report cited a significant risk of a historic default within the first 2 weeks of June. The U.S. Congressional Budget Office CBO report issued recently confirms Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's earlier warnings that a default could come as early as 1st of June. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, warned there is a significant risk that at some point in the first 2 weeks of June, the government will no longer be able to pay all of its obligations. Congress's budget scorekeeper also noted that the federal government's debt payments will remain uncertain throughout May, even if the Treasury ultimately runs out of funds in early June. President Joe Biden and his Democratic colleagues in Congress have urged prompt action to raise the $31.4 trillion statutory limit on government borrowing without conditions since the beginning of the year. Republicans, who narrowly control the House of Representatives, want new limits on future spending nailed down before they give the green light on more payments to cover borrowing on previously enacted spending. The standoff was starting to show its effect outside of Washington. Recently, the University of Michigan reported its twice-monthly reading of consumer sentiment showed households have the bleakest view of the economy in 6 months, in no small part thanks to the debt ceiling showdown. Survey director Joanne Hsu said in a statement, year-ahead expectations for the U.S. economy plummeted 23% from last month. Site of Spectrum Local News writes, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned once more that the United States is on track for default in June if the opposing Republican lawmakers do not approve the proposed budget bill hinged on debt increase and decrease in public spending. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned again on Monday, 15th of May, that it is likely that the U.S. could default on its debt obligations early next month, possibly as soon as 1st of June, if Congress doesn't act. Janet Yellen wrote to Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and other top GOP lawmakers in Congress. She said, with additional information now available, I'm writing to note that we still estimate that Treasury will likely no longer be able to satisfy all of the government's obligations if Congress has not acted to raise or suspend the debt limit by early June, and potentially as early as 1st of June. She added, the exact date of the default, or the X date, which will happen when the government no longer has enough cash to pay for its debts, depended on its credits and debit balance, or in other words, how much revenue the federal government collects and how much it has to pay out in the coming days or weeks. An October report from the White House Council of Economic Advisers warned that the possible impact of a U.S. default could be a downgrading of U.S. debt by a credit rating agency, followed by a worldwide recession, worldwide frozen credit markets, and plunging stock markets, in addition to mass worldwide layoffs. Similarly, Deutsche Bank's senior economist Brett Ryan sounded the alarm bell about a potential U.S. default. Brett Ryan said in bleak remarks, echoing what others have said, he said, if you did ride over this cliff and the government were to technically default, that would be a major problem. It would cause a global crisis. However, Republican heavyweight, former U.S. President Donald Trump, recently dismissed what Janet Yellen and her economic advisers have been warning about, the dire consequences of a global economic crisis in the case of a U.S. debt default. Speaking at the CNN town hall recently, Donald Trump advised Republican lawmakers negotiating on the budget bill with the Democratic administration not to approve it until the White House agrees to cut public spending. Trump said, if they don't give you massive cuts, you're going to have to do a default. Trump claimed the impact of a U.S. debt default is temporary and not as clear-cut as the economists claim. It could be really bad. It could be maybe nothing. Maybe it's a bad week or a bad day. Who knows? After Donald Trump's remarks, Democratic U.S. President Joe Biden said he too was not worried about a default crisis because he still believed that every cloud has a silver lining. However, Kevin McCarthy did not share Joe Biden's light feelings on the matter and seemed to be a pessimist. He told NBC News, I still think we're far apart. It doesn't seem to me yet that they want a deal. CNN cable news network has also covered this story. A U.S. Treasury Department official says the country is in for a massive recession that would cost millions of jobs if it defaults on its debts by 15th of June. The bleak warning was issued recently by Deputy Treasury Secretary Wole Adeyemo, as negotiations to forge a debt deal are expected to resume in the coming days. His remarks echoed similar warnings by U.S. policymakers, bankers, and the White House that the country is on the precipice of a default. They say a default could lead to drastic consequences for the United States, including a looming recession and likely global financial contagion. Recently, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, forecast that the U.S. could default on its debt by 15th of June, if lawmakers fail to agree on a deal with President Biden to raise current limits on government spending. Repeating the Biden administration's call for lawmakers to end the standoff and extend U.S. borrowing authority, Wole Adeyemo said in an interview with CNN, "We shouldn't be here," the Treasury official said. "If Congress failed to raise the debt limit by the time of default, we would go into a recession. And it would be catastrophic. The United States of America has never defaulted on its debt, and we can't afford that." President Biden says he wants a clean hike of the debt ceiling, but Republicans insist that any extension of the country's borrowing authority, currently capped at $31.4 trillion, comes with substantial curbs on spending.
Midstream.
Five years since the usurpation of the land and the displacement of our Palestinian people. 75 years of continuous suffering for three generations that are still groaning in pain and the occupier stealing their dreams. 75 years of persecution and distortion. 75 years of Nakba. 75 years of UN resolutions that are not worth the ink used to write them. 75 years of Zionist arrogance with British, French, American, and Western criminal support. 75 years and the faces of the